Agriculture and Rural Development Committee to order for Wednesday, March 19th. Thank you, members, for showing up promptly. We have a pretty long list of agenda items. I am going to allow Senator Bonhoff to move up a little bit because she's got a bill in another committee. I know many members will probably be stepping in and out, but we'll let Senator Bonhoff present Senate File 2527 and then come back to Senator Dietzick after that. So, Senator Bonhoff, welcome to the committee with Senate File 2527.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you so much for accommodating that. I sure appreciate it. And I do have an amendment.
Okay.
The A4 amendment. And, members, the A4 amendment is actually a delete amendment because after the bill had its first stop, we took comments from Dolly and Deed, and they actually recommended that we change the structure of how we were proposing our pipeline project. And so that would have had so many page and line changes that it was just easier to do a delete everything amendment. And in addition, it added the agricultural industry as part of our area of focus. So that's what the amendment does.
Good. Thank you very much. Senator Bonhoff moves the A4 amendment. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The A4 amendment is adopted. Senator Bonhoff, to your bill.
Thank you very much. Well, members, I'm so pleased to be here before you today talking about this bill. And this bill, actually, the idea of it came to me about, oh, gosh, how many years ago did you launch your program?
Since 2005.
Okay, so there was a ribbon cutting that I was part of at the Bueller Corporation, and you'll get a chance to hear from Renee Stainer, who is the president of Bueller. But I attended a ribbon cutting where Bueller launched their apprenticeship program in Plymouth, Minnesota. So Bueller's parent company is in Switzerland, and they have a strong presence in Germany. Their North American headquarters is in Plymouth, Minnesota. The German model of educating their young people is a dual-track model whereby students work, partner with a company. The company pays for them to go to college, and they work at that company during college, and then when they're complete with their program, they work at the company. And so Bueller has done exactly that. They've taken, and I'll let them talk about that. But that's what gave the genesis of this idea. So since that time, there's been a lot of discussion around this whole area of focus. The University of Minnesota actually sponsored a workforce trip to Germany to understand what was happening in Germany with regard to this model of education. And so what this bill does is it sets forward, and we're calling our approach the pipeline projects. We aren't calling them apprenticeship projects because they're really something different than that. They're about filling the pipeline, beginning with your high school through post-secondary into the workforce, addressing the workforce skills gap that we hear so much about, and making sure our kids get trained. So this bill identifies four areas to begin. So we've said information services, we've said advanced manufacturing, health sciences, and then because of members' interest, we've added agriculture. That in those four areas, the first step will be for Dolly to work in collaboration with Deed, University of Minnesota, MinSCU, and industry partners to develop competency standards in those four areas. Because we have learned that it works so well in Germany, partly because they have such clear standards around all the job training avenues the kids go down. So this bill simply sets forward the direction to Dolly to begin to establish these standards. And then we hope next year to come back and offer these industries the opportunity to participate in a much fuller way. So with that, I'd like to give Renee Stainer a chance to just share about how this has worked at Bueller, as well as we are here today with Zivin Zimmerman, who's a current apprentice at Bueller.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. The just a quick, our company is a worldwide company. We are worldwide in 140 companies represented. And what we are delivering into the market are complete food process plants, with other words, plants which are producing chocolate, pasta, flour for bread manufacturing, etc. So these are complete processes we are delivering into the market, state of the art, modern, fully automated. And the standards of employees needed in order to support our customers once these plants are installed needs quite a level of expertise. We found, when I came over here in 2005, that in the States it was very difficult to find these experts in the market or out of the market which were capable of taking care of plants, not just on the mechanical side, but as well on the electrical and electronical side. We have tried actually with the government to see whether that is a possibility to start developing apprentices like we do since more than 100 years in Europe, in Switzerland, Germany, in Great Britain, etc., which I just couldn't find a way. We decided then a few years ago that we may as well just start ourselves. We have started the program, and we have got a student here, which he can tell his story, why that he started with us as a student. In Europe, a student would start or would start with 15, 16 years old. He comes out of school at 15, 16, out of high school, and would start his apprenticeship. Here in the States, obviously, it's 18 years old. So under normal circumstances, we would have 18-year-old young people starting with us. After 3 years, first year mechanical, second year electrical, and then in the field, after 3 years they are experts. They can start immediately working as an expert, and they really are trained for the needs which we have. They do not have a debt, because we will pay for all the schooling, we pay for everything, we even give them a salary. They are employees of us. They're not bound to the company. They are employed by us. After 3 years, they can decide whether they want to stay with us or not. Hopefully they stay, obviously. And, well, we saw that this concept, which we had very successfully in Europe and around the world, that may as well be a good concept. And I'm glad, actually, that we have support from other industry and as well from you, Terry, to see whether we cannot develop that further into the industry.
Thank you very much. Mr. Zimmerman.
Thank you.
Mr. Zimmerman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I think I had a pretty normal course to start my career after high school for here in the United States. I went to a community college, but soon after I changed my focus, and I went to a local technical school. I graduated from that after 3 years, and I could not find a job. It was a struggle for me because I have a family, growing family. But not soon after that, I found Bueller, and ever since it's been really great, growing and learning every day, and having lots of opportunities to work with experienced professionals. And it's a good mix of both classroom theoretical training and then on the job.
Thank you very much for your comments. And Senator Bonhoff, I too want to thank you for adding agriculture. Obviously, that's very important to this committee, so thank you for doing that for us. Members, do you have any questions for Senator Bonhoff or for her witnesses? Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, thank you also. I like the concept of this program. The one question that I have, and since you and I serve on other committees, it'll probably come as no surprise to you. When we come to the competency standards and we talk about the DALI developing those competency standards, and granted there is consultation with the industries involved, which is good. I also recognize that at times government tends to take a different avenue than industry does in terms of developing standards. And if is there a means by which the industries can say, I know I'm really not comfortable with the standards, and appeal this at some point at this stage of the game?
Senator Bonner? Chair, Senator Weber, at my first stop, I was joined at the table with Amy Wallstein, who has actually been, she's, we're policy person for workforce and higher education at the Minnesota Chamber. And so she, along with my committee administrator, as well as a citizen advisor who is a retired 3M executive by the name of Bern Hapke, they worked for months developing exactly what we're doing, and the chamber wants to be very much part of this, and the industries will be represented. And so I'm saying this on the record, while we didn't specify exactly who has to be on the advisory council, we said it should be industry, but we do want equal representation and equal voice. That's the only way it'll work. That is the intent. And if that doesn't work out, then I'll come back and add stronger language next year, because that is the intent. And I believe Jessica Lumen is here from Dolly, if she could answer any questions, if the committee wanted to hear her thoughts on this too.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Did that answer your question, Ms. Senator Weber? Yeah. Okay. Any further discussion, or would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 2527? If not, Senator Bonhoff moves that Senate File 2527 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Champion, I think yours should go fairly quickly, so let's have you come up and present Senate File 2201, please.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Champion, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk about this bill, and I'm going to move expeditiously because I know that you all have some pressing items to deal with on your agenda. Mr. Chair, if I can get you to think about last session, we passed a bill to amend the existing sick leave law for employers that allows sick leave for the care of a child to also include sick leave for the care of an adult child, spouse, parent, grandparent, or step-parent. And Senator Nelson worked very hard on that legislation, not only last year, but even before that time. Last year's legislation was adopted for all employees, public and private sector, and the spirit and intent of the bill was to recognize the oftentimes employees are in fact responsible for the care of these relatives. Last year's bill also had bipartisan support, and following the adoption of last year's legislation, a number of school districts took the position that the statute doesn't apply to 9 and 10 month employees because the definition of employee required 12 months of consecutive service. And so this bill seeks to address that, and is very focused, very limited. And I do have a testifier here from Education Minnesota that can just talk about why this bill is important, and we can go from there.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Amendment.
And we'll do the amendment after.
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Okay, before we get going, and I think you might have an amendment, but,
yes.
But Senator Nelson, let's let you go, and then we'll...
Yes, thank you. I just have a question, because this does deal with education and the school calendar. I'm just wondering why it isn't in education, because that's really what it's about.
Senator Nelson, I'll ask Mr. Fuller, but I believe it has something to do with labor laws versus education. But maybe Mr. Fuller can help us.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, the title is a little misleading, I think, because it has to do with the general labor laws in Chapter 181, which is the primary jurisdiction of this committee. The amendment or the bill is designed to help school district employees, I guess, or address the situation, but it is a general labor law.
Senator Nelson.
So, Mr. Chair, my question is then, will it be going to the Education Committee? Because, and I appreciate Senator Champion, we worked on this legislation together last year. It was never an intent of this legislation to say that it did not apply to teachers. And if that's what this bill fixes, that's important. But teachers are 12-month employees. Our contracts are 12-month contracts. And so I do think it's important to be able to hear from the school districts and how this is going to affect them. And so I don't know if that's going to happen here in the Jobs Committee or if this is going to be re-referred to the Education Committee.
It's my understanding, Sarah Nelson, that the bill was originally sent to the Education Committee and they chose not to see it because of the reasons that Mr. Fuller just spoke of. If the bill is passed here favorably, it would move to Finance Committee.
So,
Sarah Nelson.
Thank you. And so, Mr. Chair, I hope we have some folks from whether it's the school boards or our school organizations to weigh in on this as well. But I want to be perfectly clear. The original bill was never intended to limit this policy from and keep it from applying to teachers.
And
not
Mr.
The intent
Chair,
of the
okay.
bill.
Senator Champion.
Just so that Senator Nelson will feel some level of comfort, we will reach out to school districts and others and make sure that they know that if they want to speak to this bill, that they will have the opportunity to do that in finance, because then they could talk about the impact, if anything, on them at that time as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
That alleviates my concerns.
Okay, good.
And so with that, we do have an amendment, Mr. Chair, and I would like to put forward the A3 amendment, which will put the bill in the order that we would like for it to be. This is the first stop, so it's an author's amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Champion would like to move the A3 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that he would prefer. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The A3 amendment is adopted. Senator Champion, now
Mr.
to your
Chair,
bill.
I'd like to make this amendment. I'd like to move this amendment. I don't think Senator Champion can. Is he on this committee?
It's an author's amendment, I think.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
That's okay. That's okay.
Well, I still think you need someone from
okay,
the committee,
okay. All right.
And I'll
so,
be glad to make this author's amendment and move the bill for Senator Champion.
Okay, let's back.
Thank you.
All right.
I appreciate that. So the testifier would just be brief.
I will be very brief. Good afternoon, Chair, committee members. My name is Jody Boer with Education Minnesota, and we'd first like to, yes, thank all of you for the bill that did pass last year to allow for additional uses of sick leave, very important for our employees, and also thank Senator Champion for bringing this bill forward. As he said, this is a very simple bill, and it is for the purpose to ensure that all of our school employees, paraprofessionals, and teachers who work 12 months are entitled to use this sick leave. We believe, as Senator Nelson said and was a supporter of the expansion last year, that was the intent of the bill. We've had some situations where there have been some confusion and possible misinterpretation when it comes to employees who are performing services and are not working over the summer, so doing 9 months, even though they are on a 12-month contract. And so we know that that was the intent of the law, that they truly are considered employees. And so the changes in this bill, in addition to the amendment, are simply to fix that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Burr.
That's it, Mr. Chair, and, okay. and would ask the committee to pass the bill and move it forward.
Senator Champion, and just to Senator Nelson's point, I think, is there anyone else who would like to be heard on this bill? It has been on the agenda since last Friday, so I know it's a busy time, but I would think that if there was opposition, they'd have an opportunity to be heard. Ms. Burr?
Mr. Chair, and specifically to Senator Nelson's question about the stakeholders, I can't speak for them, but I can tell you that we have reached out to the school boards, and per Ms. Kelleher, she believes that that is the interpretation and was the intent as well, and we'll circle back with them and confirm that again, and they can speak with you as well. So thank you.
Okay. Senator Nelson? Okay. Any further discussion? If not, I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson moves that Senate file 2201 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you,
Senator Mr. Chair, and thank you,
Committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Dietzick, Senate file 1964. Senator Dietzick, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill. Senate File 1964 establishes requirement for purchasing used electronic devices. Some kiosks and some stores will give you quick cash for electronic devices. You can get up to $500 for these devices, but so can the bad actors. There have been assaults and thefts of electronic devices in the news lately, and some of those were for the quick cash. Late last year, I was at a meeting with Senator Bonoff, MPD, Minneapolis Police Department, and the University of Minnesota, and we asked them, what could we do to help? The police said, stop the cash. That got me thinking. In 2008, the legislature changed the law so that people could no longer get cash for scrap metal, and they had to show an ID. And that law helped reduce copper thefts. This bill copies that law and prohibits the purchase of used cell phone or other wireless electronic devices for cash. The bill also outlines other requirements to help law enforcement. It gives them additional tools. The goal is to help deter criminals. I have an amendment, or possibly two, that I believe is up there that I'd like passed out. These amendments are based on conversations with cell phone companies and retailers, and I'd like to thank the cell phone companies, the retailers, and law enforcement for their input on the bill and for making this a better bill. With me today is Minneapolis City Councilmember Jacob Fry and Hennepin County Sheriff Rich Stanek. I'd like to ask them to say a few words, and then we can go over the bill and answer any questions.
Perfect. Thank you, Senator Dietzick. Thank you for your hard work on this bill. And gentlemen, whichever one of you would like to go first, please
go ahead,
feel
Jacob.
Free.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jacob Fry, and I'm a City of Minneapolis council member, specifically for the 3rd Ward, which includes downtown Minneapolis, North Loop, as well as northeastern parts of the university. While cell phone theft is an incredibly important issue nationwide, about 30% of the thefts nationwide are resulting from cell phone theft. That's $1.6 million per year and about $30 billion in total value. It's an even more important issue in Minneapolis. It's about 40% in Minneapolis and even more than that in the ward in which I represent. So if we just lop off that 40 or 50%. I mean, we're looking at knocking half of the total thefts in our city off, and specifically the ward I represent. So it's an incredibly important issue, not to mention these thefts, by their very nature, are often violent. It's called apple picking, one, because it's easy, and two, because you go up to the individual, you knock them upside the head, and you take their cell phone. You can then turn around and get $300 or $400 if you go to one of the kiosks in the mall. So this is an important issue. I would appreciate your support, and I will hand it back to Senator Dzietzik.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, thanks very much for having me here this afternoon. My name is Rich Stanek, Sheriff in Hennepin County. Now, I'm here in support of Senate File 1964. Seems weird with that year, but all right. And nationwide, as you know, Mr. Chair and members, there's been a dramatic increase in street level robberies. And, you know, honestly, much of this increase is attributed to emerging technology, smartphones, tablets, you name it. Many of us in the room have them. Jacob referred to apple picking. That's what we call when you take these smartphones, iPhones, iPads. Pretty common thing. It's a catchy name, but at the end of the day, it means a lot to a lot of people. Now, these robberies have become a low-risk and a high-payoff crime for many of the folks who wish to take them. The criminals are generally young adults or juveniles working in a pack. Now, they're going to find someone walking or standing alone using their iPhones to send or text a message, maybe on Facebook or post it, and then they're going to attempt to take it by force, as Jacob Fry mentioned. Once they obtain the device, they don't keep it for their own use, but rather within a very short time frame, many of them will sell them either for cash, maybe $300, $400, $500 range. It's easy cash. A simple comparison to a recent bank robbery in Hennepin County really illustrates, I think, the crux of this emerging issue that Senator Dietzick's trying to address. You compare the risk-reward ratio to a recent bank robbery where the suspect got about $250 cash. $250 cash is the reward. The potential risk, however, is a federal criminal conviction with 10 years in prison. A quick cell phone theft that can net no more cash than the bank robbery did with much less risk. That is one of the reasons why we're seeing such an uptick in these street-level robberies. And Mr. Chair, members, late last year, several leaders from law enforcement community testified, as she said, in the Senate Higher Education Committee. We were discussing safety on metro area campuses, and a large amount of that hearing was dedicated to the increasing trend of cell phone thefts. Our local experiences, 30 years of law enforcement experience, myself and many others who testified that day, and talked about seeing an increase across the country. In fact, in the last 12 months, New York City has seen a significant increase on their robbery statistics. We estimate as law enforcement officers about one in every three robberies nationwide involve this apple picking or smartphone, iPad, tablet thefts. Apple pickers seek out areas where there's a lot of foot traffic, places they can get in and out of quickly, and where there are a lot of potential victims. Now, people ask me all the time, Mr. Chair, members, well, what can you do about it, Sheriff? Well, from a law enforcement perspective, we do a lot of things like information sharing, increased patrols, and educating individuals about personal safety. Primarily, though, we do three things: enforcement, education, and prevention. Enforcement, well, that's pretty easy. The tactics that we use are very straightforward. In terms of prevention, though, that's why you need Senate File 1964. It's something that's real. It's something that can be done. And with the buy-in and support of the industry, it's a good way to spend our resources. In addition to our work in law enforcement, Mr. Chair, members, I applaud our policymakers who are coming with and really debating some additional ways, again, to prevent this from happening. I think Senate File 1964 is an example of this. And Mr. Chair, members, it concludes my comments this afternoon. I'm happy to stick around for any questions you or the committee members might have. Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Sheriff. I know this is an important issue, and Senator Dietzick, I appreciate all your hard work. Do members have questions for either the testifiers? Otherwise, we can move on to some amendments. But let's go to Senator Dames and then Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know who can answer this, but it on the amendment just said that does not apply to wire communication devices, device dealers regulated under Chapter 325J. Can somebody give me some idea what 325J, who that pertains to?
Senator Dietzick?
Yeah, Chair Sparks. I'm Senator Dames. It's the so if you are a retailer regulated under 325J, that's the pawn shop industry statute, and they actually have stricter regulations than what's here. We copied a lot of their stuff, but we're not requiring. They have longer time where they have to maintain the stuff. They may or may not have to include fingerprints, and we're not asking for that in this law. And so those requirements are actually a little more stringent. And so rather than having them into where they have conflicting statutes, we're just telling them, no, you have to follow that 325J if you are regulated under 325. They also are – a lot of cities have ordinances, and so they're also involved in that. And so that is we just felt rather than to, for consistency's sake, if you're a pawn shop dealer, you're under that chapter.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Bonner.
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have a bill up another committee, so I just wanted to take the opportunity to comment. Sheriff Stanek, I greatly appreciate what you did when we had the crisis at the university, and I thank Senator Dietzick for bringing this forward and for being a part of the community putting forward solutions. And so we actually plan to have another hearing to update the committee on what's happening and welcome your input in terms of the increased collaboration that we're now seeing. So thank you.
They can fit together.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Senator Dietzick. So we can move in the way of that. Okay. Senator Weber, I'm sorry.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I understand the issues involved here, and certainly we want to be cooperative in helping solve them. One of the issues, I was just quickly going through some things here. One of the issues I know that was involved with the salvage yards was there was a rather cumbersome process for them originally to find out some of the details concerning the crime that might prompt a lookout for materials. In this situation, what I've read, I don't sense that there is a requirement of the dealer to have to go online to check any records for the purchase of every used cell phone that they make. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, and Robert, a lot of the retailers are already doing that, and so that's what we have in the one of the amendments that you'll see. It should say that the cell phone companies and their authorized dealers are exempt, and a lot of them already are doing that. They have pretty stringent trade-in programs that are similar to some of the details laid out in the bill, very similar, and so that's why we're kind of carving them out. We know they are not the bad actors, and they are they're already working with law enforcement to help reduce this, and so but a lot of them already do that. There is a national registry that started probably last April. It was up and running. Law enforcement and the cell phone company spent a lot of time and resources to develop this and hope that it becomes a national and possibly international list. And so people can register that. Law enforcement can go on and they can check the IDs of the phones, basically the VIN number of the phone, and make sure it's not stolen. Senator Schumer and some other senators nationwide are trying to add some more resources and teeth to that bill to help make that another tool for law enforcement. And so a lot of the companies already have that. So we're not requiring them to do that because a lot of them are already doing that separately. And then this one is basically just so what we're finding in my community and others communities I've talked to, law enforcement, they kind of know which stores and which the bad apples and the kiosks people are going to, and they're getting the cash, but they have nothing, they're not breaking any laws. And so this is to kind of give them just another tool, because they know the cell phones. These rings of people are going in, taking the cell phones. You know, you're on sitting on the bus, and they're literally coming by and picking it up and running out the door, or they're, you know, like Councilmember Fry said, bashing you over the head and then taking your cell phone. And people have ended up with concussions and pretty serious injuries with this. And so they're taking that cell phone, getting cash, but the police are basically saying they're, you know, they can't prove the person coming in to stop them, to prove that, and they can't stop them to say, we believe that phone is stolen. And so they know this ring is going on, but the stores aren't actually doing anything illegal. So this will say, you can't get cash, you have to keep these records. And then that will, police will have access to the records. And then if they're giving cash, they can, you know, stop them and, you know, at least shut that down. So that's the hope.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Weber and Senator Dietzick. Maybe we should move. Do you have both the amendments, Senator Dietzick? I have an A4 amendment and also an A5 amendment. Members should have both
yes,
those.
Yes, I don't have the A5, but I have the A4.
All right, we'll get you one. Why don't we act on the A4 amendment, members? Again, I just want to thank Senator Dietzick. I know this has been a long process, but she's worked hard with all the providers, and obviously we found that there's a real issue with this apple picking. So do members have questions on the A4 amendment? If not, Senator Eakin moves the A4 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The A4 amendment is adopted. And then now, Senator Dietzick, do you also have the A5 amendment at
yes.
this time?
Yes.
And again, this is just work that she's done with the industry to get the bill in the shape she'd like. So Senator Eakin will again move the A5 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The A5 amendment is adopted. So now we have Senate File 1964 in the shape that Senator Dietzick likes it. Would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 1964?
One question.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, are there any issues that the industry had that are of concern that maybe haven't necessarily been worked out entirely to their satisfaction?
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Chair Sparks. And Senator Weber, we're still working with retailers. There's still some question on, do most of their stores and the good stores and the larger stores, do they include authorized dealers? We want to make sure that we're not, I mean, the goal is not to be burdensome to the stores and to the everyday people. It's literally to give law enforcement a tool on the bad actors, and so we are working with them and we'll continue to work with them. The next stop, if we are lucky enough to get through here, is judiciary. So we're continuing to talk to them. We believe this will carve out a lot of the larger stores, but we want to make sure, and I've asked them to go back and find out if there are some other mom-and-pop stores that are legitimate. We don't want to overburden them, so we're continuing to chat with them to refine it a bit.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The one concern I have is that sometimes if things tighten here in the metro area, you know, it doesn't take that long to get farther out into the state, and whereby maybe some of these things do not happen on a regular occurrence and what have you, and also there may not be as great of frequency with which the operators have the working relationship with the law enforcement and those issues. And I'm just worried that some of these smaller mom-and-pop shops, as you mentioned, might get inadvertently caught up in the problem.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Senator Weber. Yeah, I am very cognizant of that fact, and so I literally asked the retailers, go back and find out what stores are there that we might be impacting to make sure that we don't, again, overburden them. And then we've also heard potentially where there are some mom-and-pop stores, maybe not in, you know, the core Minneapolis area, but in some other areas, that maybe are feeling pressure to buy some of these phones that they know are stolen, and this may give them some protection too. And so it's kind of working both ways, but I'm working with the retail association and retailers to not overburden people and to make sure, and specifically asked about those mom and pop stores that are out there in greater Minnesota.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Weber. Good question. Thank you, Senator Dietzick. Any further questions? If not, Senator Eakin moves that Senate File 1964 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Judiciary. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you very much, Senator Dietzick.
Thank you. Thank you, members.
Senator Saxon. Senate File 1919.
Nice to see you. Very limited.
Senator Saxhog, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, today I'm presenting Senate File 1919. I do have the A5 amendment.
Okay, he's got an amendment.
Is that... While that, Mr. Chair, while that amendment's being handed out, I guess I'd say that this bill's gone through several committees, and the language has continued to be worked on by stakeholders throughout the process. This amendment reflects the latest agreement between the stakeholders, and I would like Kyle Macarios, Director of Governmental Affairs for the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters, to explain this amendment.
Senator Saxhog, maybe should we move the A5 amendment to kind of put
that'd
the
be great, Mr.
language?
Chair.
Okay. Senator Coonan moves the A5 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Okay. The motion prevails. The A5 amendment is adopted. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Marcos.
Mr. Chair, I'm aware of one small amendment. Maybe Senator Nelson might be offering it, that wouldn't be a bad thing to have offered at this time either.
Yes.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Senator Saxhog. And Mr. Chair, I'm looking for that amendment.
Okay.
I do have a great amendment to offer. Here it is.
Oh, you got it? Okay.
Oral amendment.
Okay.
All right. Senate File 1919. Members, on page 3, I hope it's written to the delete all here. Page 3, line 9, after the one, oh, I think it's not, Mr. Chair, I think this is not drafted to the delete all amendment.
Okay.
So I'm going to need just a couple minutes.
Okay, let's do this, Sarah Nelson. Yep. We'll come back. Why don't we take a little testimony, and we'll give you time just to make sure that we're on the amendment and get the changes that you want. Okay? All right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kyle Macarios. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters. Thank you, committee members, for taking time to hear this bill today. Senate File 1919, as amended, is a bill that would modestly change the state's procurement statutes to ensure that when public entities are hiring construction contractors, we're hiring contractors that abide by our laws. While the vast majority of construction contractors play by the rules, it's widely acknowledged in the construction industry that there are a number of unscrupulous contractors that skirt the law in order to win bids. Too often, these contractors end up continuing to violate the law on projects paid for by the taxpayers. Not only are these contractors cheating the taxpayers and often their employees, but they're also gaining an unfair competitive advantage in bidding against legitimate employers that follow the rules. As Senator Saxhog mentioned, we've had long discussions with a number of industry partners, and this delete all amendment represents compromise language that we're offering meant specifically to address concerns raised by contractor associations public entities and others. Here's how this bill, as amended, will help to alleviate the situation. Under this bill, contractors that bid on work from state or local government will have to sign a statement under oath that they meet a set of minimum criteria. All of these criteria are in current law. They'll have to verify that they comply with and have not had any recent violations of these laws, such as requirements to pay for workers' compensation and unemployment and to have a tax ID number. They can't have had major violations of a series of wage and hour laws, including overtime, child labor, and prevailing wage requirements. They can't have violated a municipality's requirements for payment of wages on a recent contract. They must abide by laws prohibiting illegal subcontracting schemes, payroll fraud, and employee misclassification. They must show good faith efforts to meet goals for hiring disadvantaged businesses. They can't have operated under a false front as a disadvantaged business, and they can't currently be debarred by the federal government, the state, or any local government. We tried very hard to craft this bill without putting more than a very minimal administrative burden on either legitimate employers or on public agencies. Contractors simply have to sign a statement that they meet the criteria, and public agencies only have to accept it and receive it. If it turns out that a contractor submits a false statement, then they're in breach of contract and ineligible to work on public contracts for 3 years. You're going to hear in just a moment from Mr. Melander and several contractor associations, and Mr. Chair, however you like to proceed, but when they're finished making their statements, I would be glad to take more technical questions.
Mr. Chair, I want one clarification, if I could, from Mr. McCarris, and that's when we're talking about subcontractors signing certificates or signing sworn statements, and it's the general contractor, of course, has his own set of obligations, but he's only collecting these and sending them in, right?
Mr. McCarris?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Saxog, you are correct. A general contractor is responsible to sign a sworn statement that they have not violated any of these laws, and then they're responsible for accepting, for collecting the sworn statements of their first-tier subcontractors under the amended language.
Thank you for that clarification. Senator Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm ready with this amendment.
Okay.
I'd like to offer an oral amendment to the A5 amendment. Members, it's on page 3, line 9, after the I, insert willfully and respectfully before the word fails, and do the same on page 3, line 28, after the word has, insert willfully or repeatedly. Mr. Chair?
Senator Nelson.
I think this is an important amendment. I want to thank the groups that have worked so hard to bring this to us in a better shape today. I think it's a more of a scalpel approach as opposed to a sledgehammer. I think we get better results when we do that. And I think adding these two words just kind of further helps us make sure that we are doing what was intended here, which is protecting taxpayer dollars from going to contractors who willfully and repeatedly violate state law.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson? So the two words in both cases are willfully and repeatedly.
Or repeatedly.
Yes. Willfully
or repeatedly. Yes.
In both days. Okay. I certainly accept that as a friendly amendment.
Yes, sir. Okay. Members understand what Senator Nelson is trying to do here? Okay. All those in favor of the Senator Nelson oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. The motion prevails. The oral amendment. Mr. Melander or Senator Saxon?
Well, if there's no other questions on the amendments, Mr. Chair, with me today is Harry Melander of the Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Council, Gary Thadnut from the National Electrical Contractors Association, and Matt Marquis from Management Guidance LLP, and they'd like to get some testimony.
Certainly. Mr. Melander, welcome to the committee.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Harry Melander. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Council. Our organization represents 55,000 and growing because of, as I like to say when I approach committees, of all the good work that you've done over the last 2 or 3 years, we have thousands of Minnesotans that are back working, feeding their family, and off the unemployment line. So on behalf of our membership, we appreciate all the good work that you've done then and into the future. This bill, Senate File 1919, is a pretty straightforward bill. We've talked to a number of our participating partners, not only on the management side, but also within the labor community. And I just want to say somewhat tongue-in-cheek, just on behalf of those contracting partners, that if we're in the dentist, we still have a toothache, but there's no root canal. So we're moving forward with this thing, and we believe it's a good bill. This bill, what it will do, it's very straightforward and simple. It's about honesty. It's about responsibility. It's about transparency. And this bill will protect the quality and fairness of public construction jobs by making sure that those that cheat and break the law on public jobs are not awarded public work. We feel, and I'm sure that you do, that taxpayers' money should be used in an appropriate way. And the majority of people in our state do that. But from time to time, we find individuals, not only in the past, but even presently, not playing by the rules. And I just like to share with you just a couple of examples recently that we've been made aware of. For instance, in 2012, in a Minnesota State College University project, North Hennepin College produced documents and evidence that violations were shared with us from the Department of Labor and Industry. At that time, DLL found four contractors that had wage violations on a state project totaling $23,000. One of the subcontractors on that project was also the prime focus of a federal wage and hour investigation on a federally funded project in Woodbury the year before. That subcontractor was responsible for the majority of $370,000 of federal wage violations on that project. Beyond that, Mr. Chair, committee members, not only do we have problems within state projects, but within our cities and the city of St. Paul, and primarily within our school districts. We believe that this bill will provide a tool that the public bidding law does not provide right now, and it will allow our agencies, our school districts, to make sure that when contractors come onto the projects, not only are they going to provide quality work to those municipalities, those school districts, but more importantly, they'll play by all the rules that all of us have to abide by. So with that, we just think it's a great bill. It's a very simple bill. We think it's good for us. We think it's good for you, and we believe it's good for the state of Minnesota. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Melander. Any questions for Mr. Melander? If not, Mr. Thadden, welcome.
My name is Gary Thadden. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Minnesota Mechanical Contractors Association and the Minnesota Contractors of the National Electrical Contractors Association. Those 300 contractors do electrical, plumbing, heating, and air conditioning work throughout the state of Minnesota. They often compete on both state and local jobs, and they enjoy doing this work. This bill is an extremely important bill to make sure that the few bad actors out there do not get government money and they do not compete adversely with the contractors who are doing the work properly and abiding by the law. I was at the dentist this morning, Harry, and I did not have a root canal work, and I will say that testifying here is much easier than going to the dentist.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Matt Marquis, and I'm here representing five different subcontractor associations today: the Carpentry Contractors Association, the Minnesota Drywall and Plaster Association, the Minnesota Environmental Contractors Association, the Minnesota Floor Covering Contractors Association, and the Minnesota Painting and Wall Covering Employers Association. These groups together represent over 100 different contractors employing thousands of Minnesota workers. As both Mr. Melander and Mr. Mercarios have indicated, we worked long and hard trying to come to a compromise on this. Our associations see a real problem, and we're hoping that this will level the playing field. We hope that you pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Raines, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, committee members and chair. My name is Phil Raines. I'm with Associated Builders and Contractors. We appreciate this bill as a work in progress. I think the bill has come a long way from the starting line, and I very much appreciate how the author and proponents of this bill have pushed to clean up some of the language, and really appreciate what the committee's done here today in adopting the willful or repeated violations to ensure that we don't have inadvertent violations tossing good contractors out with the bad contractors. So thank you very much, and I appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Raines, for your comments. And that's what we try to do in this committee is good government, right, members? Anyway, further discussion or any questions for Senator Saxhawk? If not, Senator Nelson moves that Senate file 1919 as amended be recommended to pass.
And referred to the floor, Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir. Senator Saxhawk. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Saxhawk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Sieben, Senate File 1956. Senator Sieben, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1956 is a piece of legislation that's part of the Women's Economic Security Act. The goal of the legislation is to put into law reasonable language that allows for pregnant women to be able to continue to perform their jobs. There are three main components of the bill. First, it expands unpaid leave under the Minnesota Parental Leave Act from 6 to 12 weeks and allows the use of leave for pregnancy-related issues. This legislation in its entirety only applies to companies with more than 21 employees. Second, it allows parental leave to occur in the 6 months following the birth or adoption of a child, and it proposes that employers make reasonable accommodations for pregnant employees, such as allowances for additional food and water, restroom breaks, or use of a stool or a chair. So the legislation passed out of Judiciary Committee last week, and the advocates and I have been working with the business community, and the A4 amendment is some of those, is the result of some of the suggestions that they made. So, members, do you have the A4 amendment in your packets?
Do you have the A4 amendment? Yeah, I think it's coming around, Senator Sieben.
Okay. Do you want me to start to explain it or wait?
Go ahead. We'll get it to the members, but if you'd like to start explaining a little bit of what's been going on, that'd be wonderful.
Okay. So the A4 amendment, again, is the result of conversations between the business community and the advocates for this bill. And the changes that we made include the original language states that a parental leave must start within 12 months of the birth or adoption of a child. My language in the A4 amendment proposes that we change it to 6 months. The business community wanted to change it to 3 months, but I thought that 6 months was reasonable. And because I can speak from experience here and with my friends, that if, remember that parental leave applies to both men and women. So if a family wanted the woman to use their 12 weeks of unpaid leave first, then at the conclusion of that 12 weeks, the male could take their unpaid leave. And so that's why I thought 6 months was a reasonable number. So again, the original legislation as it passed out of judiciary was at 12 months, and I'm proposing we change it to 6 months at the request of the business community, who wanted it to be 3 months. The A4 amendment deletes the phrase related health condition, which again was at the request of the business community. We change the language, or the A4 changes the language to clarify that a pregnant woman would not need a doctor's note to have access to additional food or water, restroom breaks, or a chair, but a woman would need to obtain a medical note for other reasons if requesting an accommodation from an employer. Fourth, a reasonable accommodation could include a transfer to a less hazardous work environment in rare instances. For instance, if a pregnant worker requests a temporary transfer to not operate a jackhammer at a construction site, or to move out of a work site in which toxic fumes could pose a threat, a note would be required for these, a medical note. And we added language requested by the businesses that the employer and the employee must enter into an interactive process with regard to the request for an accommodation. Finally, we added language that employees are not required to take a leave or accept an unwanted accommodation. So, Mr. Chair, if you'd like to hear from my testifiers now, or you want to, if someone would move the A4 amendment, if that's the appropriate time, whatever you'd like.
Okay. Let's move the amendment, and then we'll hear from your testifiers, and then we'll let members chime in, if that's okay with you, Senator Sieben?
Yes.
All right. Senator Schmidt will move the A4 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The A4 amendment is adopted. Okay, Senator Steben, two-year bill. And I guess you can introduce your witnesses and welcome to the committee.
My name is Frances Mueller. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm here today to testify in support of this bill. Women need reasonable accommodations during pregnancy. Pregnant women shouldn't feel bad about having to use the bathroom more frequently or worried that by asking to use the bathroom they will lose their job. Many people will say that this does not happen in today's day and age. However, while pregnant with my son, my former employer did everything she could to not provide reasonable accommodations for me. I began my employment as a second to the top florist and eventually became the top florist. As the top florist, I was solely responsible for all of the larger projects. Unfortunately, my employer did not trust other employees to share in this responsibility, which became an issue once I became pregnant and needed additional accommodations. On many occasions, I was expected to hold my urges to pee, to stand for an entire shift, to not take breaks, to eat or rest, and to, above all, never require accommodations that are often needed during pregnancy. At the end of my shift each day, my feet killed, even with the highest quality shoes you can buy for a position that requires standing. If I sat down even briefly, my boss would tell me to stand up and appear active for customers. As time went on, my ankles swelled badly and needed to be iced at night. When I was about 5 months pregnant, I decided I would sit down even if I were reprimanded. This resulted in my employer asking other workers about my pregnancy. She asked them if I was having a difficult pregnancy, which I was not. She told me that when she was pregnant, she never needed special accommodations. My employer told me and other workers that all her female employees get pregnant and quit. She openly stated, "I need to hire more men." I only assume because they can't burden her with getting pregnant. When I was 7 months pregnant, I decided to quit because work had become difficult and hostile. I decided I just couldn't take standing day in and day out, not being able to use the bathroom, and being made to feel bad for being pregnant. Thankfully, my husband was able to support our family. However, if I had been a single mom or needed the additional income, this would have been a nightmare. There is an assumption that pregnant women do not face difficulties navigating the workplace. I'm here today to demonstrate that they do. I'm here to share my story because I don't want other women to go through what I did. I'm here because women deserve better. I ask to please support this bill so other women will not be faced with the difficult situation I was faced with. Thank you for hearing my testimony today.
Thank you, Mrs. Mueller, for your testimony. Senator Steben?
Mr. Chair, the next testifier is Lisa Stratton with Gender Justice.
Okay. Ms. Stratton, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Stratton. I'm an attorney and the founder and executive director of Gender Justice. We're a nonprofit law firm, and our goal is to eliminate gender barriers in any place they show up, including the workplace and schools. So we have an open door at Gender Justice to Minnesota women and men. Anyone who feels that they're facing a barrier based on their gender, which arises from assumptions or stereotypes about them. And one of the calls that we receive very frequently is that caused the issue before you today. There is a gap in our current laws, and pregnant women, as you heard from Frances, fall into that gap. There really is not a provision in our current law, people are often surprised by this, that covers very simple basic needs that would allow a pregnant woman to continue working while she's pregnant for as long as possible, if not completely throughout the pregnancy. This is extremely important in Minnesota because nearly 80% of mothers of children under the age of 6 in Minnesota are in the paid workforce. And we need to make it possible for them to continue to support their families while still having healthy pregnancies. I second what Senator Steben said. We've been doing a lot of talking in the last week or so with various representatives of the business groups representing employers. And we have made a number of changes. In after each committee hearing, there have been changes. And at this point, I think we have something that was I'm not going to say there aren't objections. I'm sure there still are. But we have made a lot of progress and made a lot of changes to accommodate employers' interests. And I will also say that it is true that many employers do this already. My message is not that all employers are bad and no one is doing anything right and they're not taking the steps they should to accommodate women. Many, many, many of them do. The problem is that some don't. And this bill is about and for the some that don't and won't. The employer who will not let an employee take a break to sit on a stool occasionally throughout the day to make it possible to continue to do her job, which is normally always standing. I have heard of employers who will not let a woman have more frequent access to water or have water with them while they're on the job, and to the point where that has led to severe dehydration. The kinds of things that we're talking about are inhumane, and they aren't in any of our interests. And this bill is designed to be fair. It's got a reasonableness standard. It is not going to require employers to do anything that is not within their reach already. It's just going to give women something to have in hand to say, I need this minor change, and have a little bit of power in negotiating to ask for it. Women were typically just ignored and forced out of the workplace. And that happens, I think, in part because of our notions, long-held notions about women not being in the workplace, and particularly in non-traditional work for women and in low-income work sites where the jobs are less flexible and often have some physical component, and are also those jobs also tend to be the ones that are low-wage. That's where the problems occur the most. And this bill would go a very long way toward helping women continue to work and support their families while pregnant.
Mr. Chair, I believe that in your packet is a flyer that shows the changes that are proposed for different size employers. So, again, everything in this bill that's before you only applies to employers with 21 or more employees.
Okay, thank you. The members should have that in their packet. Thank you. Next on the list, I have Ms. Cadoon with the Chamber of Commerce, if you'd like to come forward. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. First, want to say that we are trying to and have been working with the advocates, and certainly appreciate their willingness to talk with us on this bill, and appreciate the amendment that was put on by Senator Sieben. It does take care of some of our concerns, some things that we had flagged with her with the language regarding other health conditions. We appreciate her taking that out. We're certainly fine with and appreciate the compromise on the language regarding that 12-month, reducing that to 6 months. We appreciate that change. But we do have still some concerns. And what we're really trying to prevent is really unnecessary litigation. We want to make sure that everybody's rights and responsibilities are clear under this law. We're trying to make sure there's unnecessary litigation that we can avoid. So when we believe that's beneficial both for the employee and the employer. Some of the items, and this is the first we saw the amendment, so we're trying to quickly digest this. It's a complicated area of the law when you're dealing with employment law, so we want to make sure that we're hopefully highlighting the particulars that we've seen at this point. But some items that we just flagged that we still think are some language that we would hope that we could continue working on. One is regarding the written documentation. We concern that we have, if you look at line 1.6 of the amendment, is that it's not required by a licensed medical provider. We think that would be an important change to include. One other provision that we had been talking to the advocates about, and I thought we had come to agreement, which was with dealing with the undue hardship. That language is not included in the current bill. If you look at all the Minnesota Human Rights Acts, you look at the ADA, when you're dealing with reasonable accommodation, all those bills also include then undue hardship.
That language is not part of this reasonable accommodation language. We think it's important to include that undue hardship language as well. There's a whole body of case law that deals with this, both at the state and federal level, and so we would think it's important to include that language because that really would, I think, minimize litigation exposure as well as make it clear exactly what's meant regarding that reasonable accommodation. The other item that I did want to flag as well, which was on the new language under Subdivision 4, which starts at line 1.20 of the amendment, we're not really clear exactly how this works. It seems that it provides the employee really veto power over what sort of accommodations would be provided, and think that language needs additional work. With that, it's down for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cadoon.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben.
I, when looking this over, too, realized that we inadvertently deleted language that we didn't want to delete. And Mr. Fuller can perhaps instruct how to fix this. In the legislation that came to the committee on lines 2.34, continuing on to the next page, the final page, the sentence that says, no employer shall be required by this subdivision to create additional employment that the employer would not otherwise have created. And then it goes on. I didn't intend for that to be.
I think Mr. Fuller can help us out here, Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, so it's that whole sentence from 234 to 3.2.
Right, but Mr. Fuller, as you remember, we also in the amendment combined the two subdivisions of Section 3. So if you need to reference it differently, that may be the best. You may have to suggest how to do that.
Give me 2 minutes.
Okay. Let's let him just have a minute to kind of look at it, and then we can come back to that if that's okay. But I think we understand what you're trying to do here. Okay, Senator Sieben? Do members have any questions while we let Mr. Fuller work a little bit? Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, would this be the time to offer an amendment to the amendment?
You want to move on this first?
I know what she's doing. It won't conflict.
Okay. Senator Nelson.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I support Senator Sieben's amendment as well to reinsert that additional language. And when we have that ready, I'd be glad to offer that as well. But in the meantime, members, I would offer an oral amendment to Senator Sieben's bill as amended. So on the A4 amendment, on line 1.7, after the word accommodation, insert the following, and the accommodation does not impose an undue hardship on the employer. And then there's a second piece as well to protect the employee, and that is on line 1.8, where it talks about the pregnant employee shall not need to provide documentation of medical necessity. After the word necessity on 1.8 list, nor may any employer claim undue hardship for the following conditions. So we want to protect the employee, and at the same time we want to make sure that the employer is not held to an undue hardship. And if there's any questions, I'll be glad to further address that.
I can kind of share. Okay, Senator Nelson.
I could read the first part again.
Can you come back?
Yes. Mr. Chair and committee members.
On 1.17, Senator Nelson.
1.1, on line 1.7 of the A4 amendment, insert the following words. And the accommodation does not impose an undue hardship on the employer.
Okay.
And on line 1.8... after the word necessity, insert, nor may an employer claim undue hardship. And if you like, Mr. Chair, I'll read the entire text as amended.
Okay. Why don't you do that? That might help clarify.
Yes. So I'm going to start at the beginning of the sentence, which is line 1.4, the accommodation. An employer must provide reasonable accommodations to an employee for the employee's medical or physical conditions related to pregnancy or childbirth. If the employee provides a written documentation of a medical necessity for an accommodation, and the accommodation does not impose an undue hardship on the employer. A pregnant employee shall not be required to provide documentation of medical necessity, nor may an employee claim undue hardship for the following accommodations. And those are the accommodations that Senator Sieben has listed.
Okay. Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, I appreciate these suggestions. I would resist the first part of your proposed amendment on the on adding the language and the accommodation presents an undue hardship on the employer. And the reason why is because there's a standard of reasonableness that is proposed already in the language. So further down in the language, it defines what reasonable accommodation is. We had this discussion in the Judiciary Committee about an undue hardship, the difference between reasonable accommodation and an undue hardship, and the Judiciary Committee passed it out with the test of reasonableness staying in the language as it is. To the second point that you make about the employer claiming undue hardship, I think that I think I'm fine with that language. So if you want to, if I don't know what you want to do, but I would say that I don't support the first part of it, but I do support the second.
Senator Nelson?
Mr. Chair, my amendment goes together as a whole. So half does not accomplish the goal.
Okay.
And so, but Mr. Chair,
Senator Nelson,
would it be possible to have just a, maybe I should recess, or I guess I won't call for a recess, but I actually just need to further clarify this language and maybe, because I think we're all on the same page here, but I'm just not clear that the language that we have is getting us there. So perhaps I could, do you have, if Senator Sieben has more testifiers, maybe I could withdraw my amendment, try and take her counsel under advisement, and then come back and reoffer it in a different form. Or in a more clean form.
Okay, Senator Nelson, let's do this. We'll give you some time again to look at that. Why don't we go back to what Senator Sieben had proposed and was working with Mr. Fuller, if you're ready.
Yes,
and
then we I'll be back. Okay. So I withdraw the my amendment to the amendment.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Chairman, members, Senator Sieben, I'm looking at the language on 1.13 of the amendment. And as I recall, that was the language that replaced the deleted language on 2 points, or was moved up, so to speak. And so it's really not gone. I think it might be slightly different. So if what you're saying is that the language, the sentence starting on 2.34 is what you want, we would then delete the language.
Well, Mr. Fuller,
the amendment.
I apologize. Senator after Sieben. I said that, then we realized that it was in here. So You were right. You drafted it correctly.
I'm astounded.
I'm not.
Okay. So
we get that. So you're good.
Okay. All right. Senator Sieben. So
Mr. Chair, and I know that Senator Nelson is working on her amendment. I want the committee to understand that in the original bill that was before us, there was a reasonable accommodation paragraph and then a paragraph on if an employee needs to transfer for a different position. At the suggestion of the business community, we made just about all of those suggestions that they made. So, but I do think if Senator Nelson proposes the undue hardship clause for the beginning part of that amendment, that it's setting a higher standard for the pregnant woman that will be difficult to accommodate, that will be difficult for the woman to meet that accommodation.
And Senator Steven, I know that you've been working hard on this too, and I appreciate that you've moved on a lot of the issues that they want. So I think that it was reasonable too to go from 12 down to 6, and we'll obviously allow Senator Nelson to offer an amendment, but we need to keep plugging along as well because we have this room for less than another hour, and bills have to get out of here tonight. So I don't know, Ms. Stratton, if you want to comment or.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think during these conversations, I think the proponents of the bill, our philosophy is that this bill just needs to work, and we need to have some common sense and practical approach to it. The bill is designed, and we accepted language that said the employer is supposed to interact and have a dialogue with the employee. We thought that was good. That was in part what the bill is designed to do. But there were a number of requests that we saw as overly technical and overlaying other areas of law and thinking of this from a litigation perspective instead of from a practical perspective, keeping it clear, simple, and clean so employers can understand it. Courts understand reasonableness, and they're not going to make they often say they're not supra personnel departments for any company. They're not going to make them do things that they can't do. And this comes up on – there were several other things where they wanted to import language from either the ADA or the Family Medical Leave Act that seemed overly technical and would make this into another one of those laws that doesn't work because it's just too darn complicated and has too many hoops that the person needing the accommodation has to jump through that have legal language and technical terms and certifications, et cetera. We just want this bill to be about – if a woman needs the accommodations and they're reasonable and they're not a huge deal, which most of the ones in here that don't require medical documentation aren't, they're water, food, little breaks, a stool, they should do it. And I think that's part of our view is that this should stay simple and clean and not be a setup for lots of litigation.
Okay, thank you. Senator Weber, and then we'll come back to Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to comment that we had a bill in front of us last week where the term reasonable accommodation came up, and I questioned it, and it was stated that that's a common phrase. I visited with my daughter, who is an attorney, and she also made the comment that reasonable accommodation is also a term upon which many attorneys have made a lot of money. So, I don't think that reasonable accommodation is necessarily a great comforting phrase. So I just wish that to be on the record.
Okay.
Senator Weber, that's why we specified in the language what we thought reasonable accommodations were, things like access to food and water, a chair, or restroom.
Mr. Chair, Senator Steven, I think the items that you've delineated there are, I'm certainly in agreement with. I just think that there's also other references to that where that reasonable accommodation has not necessarily been delineated fully. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you. Okay. Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. So as a former working mom and a middle school teacher, I can appreciate the intent of this bill greatly. It's very difficult to get to the restroom between those five-minute breaks between classes, so I get that. So I have three – I'm going to try and keep it very simple. So there are three oral amendments, and I'll do the first one very simply, which is the amendment that we visited about right before I left. So I'll reoffer that amendment to the amendment. And Mr. Fuller, do you have that clean that you can read it?
Sure.
Okay.
Mr. Fuller? Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson moves on line on the AA4 amendment, line 1.7, after accommodation, insert, and the accommodation does not impose an undue hardship on the employer. Page 1, line 8, after necessity, insert, nor may an employer claim undue hardship.
Thank you,
Mr. Nelson.
And Mr. Chair, this amendment is in response to Senator Latt's comments that specifically said we need to work on the undue hardship language. And I think both of these combined together addresses the undue hardship, and at the same time, it protects the employee for these very accommodations that are just part of really practical and we would expect this kind of treatment of all employees, to be able to have food and water and restroom breaks and seating and the ability to not lift over 20 pounds. And so I think these two phrases together in this amendment accomplish what's needed here. And so I would offer the amendment as a whole.
See if Senator Sieben has changed her mind. Otherwise, you'd like to comment on Senator Nelson's oral amendment.
Mr. Chair, I would oppose the amendment.
Okay. Any further discussion on Senator Nelson's oral amendment? Are members clear what we're trying to do here? I think Mr. Fuller stated it. Senator Nelson.
Yeah. Could Mr. Fuller restate the amendment, please? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members, the amendment is to amend the A4 amendment, which we adopted, on page 1, line 7, after accommodation, insert, and the accommodation does not impose an undue hardship on the employer. On line 8, page 1, line 8, after necessity, insert, nor may an employer claim undue hardship. So in essence, what it does is it imposes another requirement to claim an accommodation, except that for these that are specified, for which you don't need a medical documentation, you cannot claim, the employer cannot assert that it would create an undue hardship.
Thank you, Mr. Fuller. So, Mr. Chair, it just seems to me that this is a very equitable and fair way to proceed. So,
and Mr. Chair, just finally, I would point out that the language that I thought I deleted but I didn't, in lines 1.13 to 1.17, says that notwithstanding any other provision, employers shall not be required to create a new or additional position in order to accommodate an employee pursuant to this section and shall not be required to discharge, on and on. So my point is that I think there is already reasonableness that the employer is not going to, it's not going to create a big to-do for the employer.
So, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Nelson or Ms. Cadoon, would you like to comment? And then I think there will be a motion that we should probably take a vote on. But Ms. Cadoon, if you'd like to comment on this.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I just wanted to mention once again that the language that you're seeing here with the undue hardship language combined with the reasonable accommodation is the same type of language you see in the Minnesota Human Rights Act as well as the ADA. And there's a whole body of case law, both federal and state, that then helps define what reasonable accommodation and undue hardship mean. So that's why we think it's important to keep those language together, because then you don't have to have a whole new body of law coming forward, case law, to help you define that. You can look to the current case law. And, Mr. Chair, I would just add that being pregnant does not mean that you have a disability, and we don't want to set the standard that these accommodations are in some way parallel to having a disability, where there's a much higher standard for some of the test of reasonableness that would equate to having a disability. Being pregnant does not mean you're disabled.
Okay. Ms. Cadoon, and then we're getting kind of judiciary-ish here.
I realize that. the Human Rights Act already includes pregnancy under that definition of disability. So it's already included under the Human Rights Act. I agree it's not a disability, but that's where it's currently included.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator final Nelson. Comment. So I would suggest that we support this amendment, support the chair of the judiciary, saying we need to work on the undue hardship language here. And with that, I ask for a vote.
Okay. Let's members understand, I think we had a good discussion here. All those in favor of the Senator Nelson oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
No.
Nay. Motion does not prevail.
Division.
Okay. Division's been asked for. Those in favor, please raise their hands. Okay. And those opposed? Chair's ears were pretty good. The motion does not prevail.
So,
thank you, Senator Nelson.
Yes, two smaller amendments.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and committee members, on line 1.7, talking about the written documentation of medical necessity. Certainly that my amendment is after the word necessity on line 1.7, and by a licensed medical professional. And as I said, as a former middle school teacher, we know all kinds of notes are important. We want to make sure this is from a medical provider.
Okay. Senator Sieben, would you like to comment on Senator Nelson's amendment?
Mr. Chair and members, I certainly understand the intent. I would just ask for clarification that medical professionals, all medical professionals, this could apply to. For instance, nurse midwives or doctors or nurse practitioners, if Mr. Fuller has any knowledge in this area of the law, or I would be open to just saying by a medical professional, if that would.
Mr. Chair, did I forget to say the word licensed? By a licensed medical professional?
You said that.
So that would cover, that would cover all of those things.
Mr. Fuller,
is there a question? Outstanding. I mean, I'm not a total expert on this, but the time I see these words, it's just the licensed healthcare provider, or.
My amendment is.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. By a licensed medical provider, or professional, I guess I could either one. But the fact is, they're licensed, and we have a wide variety of licenses that would include APRNs. All of the categories
doulas.
That you mentioned. Doulas, I think we're just licensing doulas now or certifying doulas. So, yes, that would be the intent. And if we're not sure about the word doulas, I have no problem incorporating that if you'd like to add that.
Just add doulas.
Sure. Okay. Mr. Chair?
Mm-hmm. Senator Nelson.
Okay. Line 1.7 after the word necessity, please insert by a licensed medical provider or doula. And I think we need to say certified doula now that I'm thinking about it.
Okay. Let's let counsel kind of take a look.
Yeah.
I mean, the term by finding the workers' comp is health care provider. Yeah.
What's Miss?
Sorry. I was like, no, I'm not.
What'd you say?
Tell me about certified doula.
They were busy looking in the statute book, Senator Nelson. Could you please restate your amendment?
Yes, yes. Line 1.7, after the word necessity, insert by a licensed medical provider or certified doula.
And by a.
Well, it could be either one. Or.
Or is correct.
Door.
Okay.
Certified doula is
right. He's a host.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Fuller.
I don't think we're going to get precision. The term I find is licensed healthcare provider in the few statutes I look at. I don't know if there's a distinction here between that and a licensed medical professional. I think healthcare provider, my intuitive sense is it's broader, but I don't know that for a fact.
Senator Nelson.
Yes. Then we'll buy a licensed healthcare provider or certified doula.
All right.
Okay.
So I'll read it one more time.
All right, Senator Nelson.
1.7, after the word necessity, insert and by a licensed medical provider or
healthcare.
And by a licensed healthcare provider or certified doula.
Okay, healthcare provider.
Well, Mr. Chairman, my guess would be a certified doula is a licensed healthcare provider, but let's exercise caution.
Yes.
Okay.
We just heard it in health committee today, so. Okay.
Oh, we're getting healthcare-ish. But Senator,
Mr. Chair,
go ahead. No, this is serious. I'm not. Go ahead, yeah. Senator.
And for the uninitiated, we're all around here going, "What is a doula?" And no one wants to ask. So could you please give us that acronym,
Senator Nelson?
I don't know that it's an acronym. Actually, doula is a health trained professional specifically to help women in pregnancy and delivery. And there may be a better definition.
D-U-O-L-A.
Okay.
D-U-O.
Okay. Senator Sieben, would you like to comment?
Great. Sounds great.
Okay. All right.
Yes.
All right. Mr. Fuller, are you? Yeah. Everyone understand Senator Nelson's oral amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The Nelson oral amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one more. Okay. If I could indulge the chair. After on line 1.20, strike the language on 1.20. After subdivision 4 and replace with an employer shall not require an employee to take a leave or accept an accommodation if the employee has not requested a leave or accommodation pursuant to MnStat 181.941 or 181.9414. And this was to address the concern that we don't want an unintended consequence here where a woman is forced to take some sort of leave or accommodation because she's pregnant. We certainly want to make sure that the woman has that choice and that something is not forced upon her that, you know, maybe she wants to continue working or needs to continue working. We want to make sure that she's not forced to take a leave or some sort of accommodation if she chooses not to.
Mr.
Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, that sounds fine to me, Senator Nelson. If I could just ask counsel if they see any other, I mean, it seems like you're just restating what this
yes.
says. So if I could just confirm with counsel if they see anything that's different. I don't.
Would you okay.
No.
Yeah, let's, Senator Nelson, we're kind of, he's writing as fast as he can, but maybe you can repeat that.
Yes, I will.
Okay, thank you.
And I'll just
slowly,
say,
yeah.
An employer shall not require an employee to take a leave or accept an accommodation if the employee has not requested a leave or accommodation pursuant to MnStat 181.941 or 181.9414. This is to protect the worker.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Nelson. So, Mr. Fuller?
I understand Senator Stevens' question. So if it's not requested, I think it's all right because it's restricted to the facts that they have not requested a specific leave. They cannot force them to take it. So my understanding would be there no under circumstance they would take the leave. So I think it's all right. I mean, so if the employee does not request a leave, they can't be required to take it. I think it's equivalent.
Well, then, Senator Nelson, why do you need it?
Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair. Well, I offer this language to just further clarify that the employee is not forced to take an unaccepted leave or an unaccepted accommodation according to the statutes provided. So I think it further strengthens the bill and protects. We don't want employers to think, well, it's just cheaper to, you know, to fire the woman who's requesting a leave.
Okay.
Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, I think it is different now that I look at it, because if the employee requests an accommodation of sitting, can then the employer force him to take some other accommodation? It looks like that. Under your language, it's specific to the accommodation that's requested. Under the amended language, it would be if they make any request, then they could require an accommodation, whether or not it's what they requested. So, I mean, from a, you know, there's the intellectual difference anyway. So, in answer to your question is I don't think it is similar, and I think it may not serve you as well as your language.
And
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Fuller, and Senator Nelson. I'd ask you to consider not doing that, because I think, too, that the language on 1.20 to 1.22 is pretty clear the way it is. And what you just said makes it less clear. And I am mindful of some of the work we're trying to do this session to make our statute books crystal clear. I think the language as it exists is clear. And your language, it's referencing the statute, and it's just not quite as clear.
Okay. Senator Nelson.
So I have two. I think I can understand that, and I could accept that. I want to do two things, I guess, is the intent of my amendment here. One, I want to make sure that a woman's not forced or not put on leave of absence or forced to take an accommodation that she doesn't want to. That's the first part. And there's always a balance. And the second part is I want to make sure that the employee is not – there's not a single veto power here, so to speak. So maybe to protect what you're suggesting and also to maybe I should alter that amendment and just put a period after the word leave. Does that satisfy that the employer shall not require an employee to take a leave? And the question about the last part, Senator Sieben, is where it says, or accept an accommodation that the employee chooses not to accept. And so then what happens? I mean, that's the question. If there's not, you know, if so we understand the leave part. We're all together there. But on the accommodation part, if the employer offers an accommodation and the employee says that doesn't suit my needs, then what happens?
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Sieben,
earlier in the legislation, it says that there should be this interactive dialogue between the employer and the employee. So I think that that interactive process with respect to an employee's request for a reasonable accommodation will occur. Now, if, for instance, the employer says to the pregnant woman, okay, I know that you need more frequent you can't operate a jackhammer anymore. Instead, we're going to transfer you to Wisconsin. I'm making this up. But if they, you know, they're going to transfer you to another job, I just want the employee to be protected so that the employee can say, no, I don't want to do that, or that won't work. So I'm not trying to stop the interaction where the employer and the employee figures out what will work for the pregnant woman, but that the employer can't use an excuse to say, we're going to send you to, if you're too hot because you have to work outside, we're going to send you to work in a freezer. You know, I don't know.
Yes.
So, Senator Nelson.
That's the point of the language.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben. So I do understand the transfer or something. I think there's some more language that needs to be worked out here because I agree with you. We would hope that this interactive dialogue or whatever it's called here, we would hope those kind of things occur in our workplaces all the time. And that's how we do get the best results. We know we can't always legislate the best results. So we want to encourage that interactive dialogue. On the other hand, I believe just having the veto power saying this accommodation is unacceptable puts us in a state of a limbo. And so I'd like you to I want to consider your concern. I mean, nobody should expect a pregnant woman to be transferred to a different site or a different state in that case because she's asked for an accommodation. I don't think that's the intent that you would want. That's certainly not the intent that I would seek. On the other hand, I want to make sure that there is that interact. And when you talk about interactive, there has to be a given. There has to be an interaction between two parties. And to just have a total veto power over the accommodation, I think would lend itself towards lawsuits and all types of unintended consequences. So. And I'm going to do this on the fly, so we'll withdraw the amendment, the oral amendment. We'll try and take into account Senator Sieben's language. And after line 1.20, where the employee is not required to take the leave, we want to keep the language, an employer shall not require an employee to take a leave or accept a transfer to a different site.
An unreasonable
transfer.
No, an unreasonable accommodation. Unreasonable accommodation.
An employer shall not require an employee to take a leave or accept an unreasonable accommodation. I think that will provide that give and take and somewhat balance in that and still preserve what you're seeking. So, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Nelson.
So the oral amendment is after line 1.20, after the period, insert. After the period on line 1.21, just insert an unreasonable accommodation and end after the word accommodation. So you would strike or accept an accommodation that the employee chooses not to accept. So it provides a little bit of balance there.
Senator Nelson, could you please read the sentence?
In its totality, yes.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As amended, the line 1.20, subdivision 4, employee not required to take a leave, period. An employer shall not require an employee to take a leave or accept an unreasonable accommodation, period. And you would delete the language that says that the employee chooses not to accept.
Mr. Chair, I would oppose that amendment because I don't think that then it's giving the employee the option to say, no, I don't want that accommodation. So I like the language the way that it is, Senator Nelson.
Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair, when I look at this, I think it's pretty one-sided. We talk about reasonability and this and that, and we're going to have a crystal clear policy here. We're not near that. And I would really ask that this has already had its first hearing, so it isn't a deadline issue. And I would ask.
Yes, it is.
No, it is.
It is? Okay.
Unless it's passed in the House, which I don't know.
Because I really think that there needs to be more work done on this, and I don't think we're going to get there today. And so somehow we have to, if we're going to pass this bill out of here, we have to have some assurance that we're going to get some reasonable language on line 120 to 122, and we're not there.
Senator Sieben?
With all due respect, Senator Dames, maybe you weren't in the room, but if you want me to go over the accommodations that I made to the business community to get the bill in the shape it is right now again, I can.
You don't have to.
But I think that we have made progress, and I'm still willing to talk with them to further work on this language, but I think it's up to me as the author to respectfully tell Senator Nelson if I don't agree with one of the amendments that she's proposing.
Mr. Chair, in response to that, I'm not criticizing you for discussing this with Senator Nelson. I'm saying I don't feel that language is something that I'm willing to vote for. And so I'm asking to have it clarified. Now, that's up to you if you do not want to accept my suggestion. I don't have a problem with that. I'm not going to vote for the bill with this current language. I think it leaves the employer out in a position that's not good. If an employee says they choose not to accept, he can offer two or three different options, and if they choose not to accept them, there's really nowhere to go. And that's my point. So that's where I'll leave it.
Thank you, Senator Dames. Senator Rood.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, I think if you would, in your amendment, part of the problem that we've had in this bill is deciding what's reasonable, and now you're putting unreasonable into your amendment into the bill. And so I think when we use those subjective words, that's where we run into trouble, because what is unreasonable and reasonable? So I think if you would maybe take that word out of your amendment, it would help.
Okay. Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rood, so when Senator Nelson originally did say that what she wanted to do was just have a period after accommodation, that the employer shall not require an employee to take a leave or accept an accommodation. So to me, Senator Sieben, I guess I would say first, that the employee chooses not to is implicit. I mean, If the employer can't require an employee to take a leave or accept an accommodation, obviously it's he can't require them. He would only be trying to require them to do that if the employee didn't want it. So right. I guess I don't understand why when Senator Nelson offered to just put that period there, what you thought that weakened.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Sieben?
I don't think that that's what Senator Nelson proposed
she
earlier.
Did at one point. Yes. Mr. Okay. Chair, she did, Senator Sieben.
Yes. So, yes.
Senator Nelson.
Well, there is an amendment on the table. For history's sake, I will reiterate the first oral amendment, which was an employer shall not require an employee to take a leave, period.
Oh, but then I...
Or we
right.
could say,
that
or accept an accommodation,
yeah.
period.
Right,
and that
let's
is,
do that.
That is fine, too, if that gets to the issue. But I think it still puts us in limbo.
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, thank you for that. If you want to... I would support deleting the language after the word accommodation, to Senator Bonoff's point. If that is provides some clarity.
Senator Nelson.
I think that does provide some clarity, but to Senator Dame's point, it still is a very, it appears that it's a, well, at this point on the table, I think I will accept, we'll do that amendment. I think there's still work to be done here. So let me just clarify the amendment for the body and then make some comments. So the amendment is line 1.20 after the, or actually we can go right to line 1.21. An employee to take a leave or an accept an accommodation, period. And then just delete the rest.
Okay, that's fine. Senator Sieben.
Great.
Understand what
that's
we're
great.
Talking about? Okay. Okay, on Senator Nelson's oral amendment, all those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? No. The motion prevails. The oral amendment is adopted. Okay.
So, Mr. Chair?
Senator Nelson.
Just some final comments. I don't have any more amendments, committee. But I will say that there are some things left here to work in this bill, particularly about the undue hardship. I think that has not been addressed yet. And I'm a little still uncomfortable with the accommodation language. I'm not an attorney, but I think we often have the words reasonable and unreasonable in legislation, and it does leave some flexibility, Senator Rood, you're correct. But again, we hope that's part of that give and take that and that interactive dialogue that Senator Sieben is encouraging here. And I do believe that at the legislature, we do not want to get into the position where we are making every decision. We certainly want to allow some flexibility for those relationships and that interactive dialogue. But, Mr. Chair, where does this bill go next?
To Finance Committee.
And, Mr. Chair?
Senator Nelson.
Has it already passed out of Judiciary?
I believe so.
And so, but the comments from the Chair were to work on the undue hardship language. So I'm hoping that that language is addressed before it gets to the Senate floor. Thank you.
Fair enough. Thank you, Senator Nelson. Okay. Thank you, committee. Senator Schmidt moves that Senate file 1956 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
Nay.
Nay. Motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Sieben.
Thank you, committee.
Yes, thank you.
All right, Senator Sparks, we have Senate file 2220 before us.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to present Senate file 2220. It's the Worker Comp Advisory Council bill. I think I have some other comments, but I think just in the essence of time, the committee's been working hard, and we'd still like to get these two bills moved out tonight. So I think I'll just turn it over to the Deputy Commissioner, and she can explain the bill to the members. Oh, I do have an amendment, too. I'm sorry, members. I have a A1408-23
yes.
Author's Amendment that I'd like to offer, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Sparks, we have the A14 Amendment before us. Would you like to describe the amendment for us?
I think it's just clarifying language. It puts the bill in the shape.
Just technical language. Would you like to move that amendment?
Please, Mr. Chair.
All right. And all those in favor of adopting the A14 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Amendment is adopted. Senator Sparks.
I think I'll just turn it over to Deputy Commissioner, Mr. Chair.
Very well. If you could state your name for the record. Yeah.
My name is Chris Iden. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. And this bill, as Senator Sparks noted, was approved by the Workers' Comp Advisory Council. It's a housekeeping bill for the most part. I'll go through it section by section. Section 1 allows multiple claims of PTSD to be treated as to be aggregated for purposes of the retention limit under reinsurance. The author's amendment puts into place that this amendment would be effective as of the date that PTSD was first covered under the workers' comp law, which was October 1st of 2013. Sections 2 and 3 amend the way that special compensation fund assessments are accounted for by insurance companies. It amends the way that the insurance companies would report these to the Department of Commerce. Section 4 authorizes the Department of Labor and Industry to change references in its rules to the ICD-10 code, and that's an international classification of diagnostic codes that is occurring throughout the country, and this will allow us to bring our standards into line. Section 5 pertains to the relative fee schedule. And actually what we're proposing is to remove several clauses that dealt with the implementation of that schedule years ago, so they have no more relevance. Section 6 amends what provision that requires the department to, well, it requires employers to provide first reports of injury. Right now they can notify us by telegraph. We're removing that method of transmission. Section 7 pertains to settlements and pretrial conferences and currently makes reference to a small claims court that the department could put into effect that's never been used, and we're proposing it be deleted. Section 8 identifies a number of statutes that are being repealed. The first is a reference to the Division of Workers' Compensation. That's because that division is identified elsewhere in statute. Section 175.08 indicates that the office of the department has to be in St. Paul. That's no longer necessary. Section 175.14 talks about the reimbursement of traveling expenses. That is covered elsewhere in the law. Section 175.26 is proposed to be deleted because it's outdated and it was never used. It required the department to notify municipalities when there's a violation of a local ordinance. Section 176.1311 talks about the protection of second injury fund data, and that is redundant. There are protections for that data elsewhere. Section 176.136, subdivision 3, refers to a report that the department was required to do at the time QRCs first became recognized under the law. That's no longer necessary because those standards have long since been adopted. Section 176.2615 also refers to a small claims court, which, as I mentioned, has never been used and is proposed to be deleted. Section 176.641 is proposed to be deleted because it deals with accidents and injuries arising before the effective date of the chapter, which is 176. That was enacted in the 1950s, and we don't believe there are any folks with injuries that arose before that date.
Well, very well, Deputy Commissioner. We appreciate that. Are there any questions from the committee? Yes, Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sparks, can you tell me, do you have consensus pretty much from the stakeholders on this bill?
Senator Sparks.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, I know that this is all the work that came out of the Work Comp Advisory Council recommendation, so I believe that is correct.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Well, without any other questions, Senator Coonan moves Senate File 2220 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
And those opposed, no. Motion prevails. All right, up next, we have another Sparks bill, Senate File 2438.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 2438 is the Department of Labor and Industry's housekeeping bill. Articles 1 and 2 make needed updates to the Office of Combative Sports and Construction Codes and Licensing. The rest of the bill is cleanup of the department statutes. I also have an author's amendment for this bill I'd like to offer at this time, Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author would like.
Very well. Senator Sparks moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. No. And the amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Rakowski from the department to run you through the provisions and answer any questions you may have.
And, sir, if you could state your name for the record, please.
Senator and members of the committee, I'm John Rakowski, the legislative director for the Department of Labor and Industry. And this is our annual, quote, cleanup housekeeping bill. And this year the governor had all state agencies, as you well know, scour our statutes and get rid of obsolete statutes and dates, et cetera, et cetera. Deputy Commissioner Iden referred to some of those quote unsession repealers in the work comp bill, and I'll be referring to the unsession repealers in Article 3. But as most of you know, the Office of Combative Sports was created just a little under 2 years ago in our department, and the statute we took our first shot at cleaning it up last year in our housekeeping bill, which, Senator Schmidt, you carried that bill. It's mixed martial arts and boxing. It's new to our department. It's a highly mobile group of individuals, these combatants. There's a lot of folks that are licensed in this, so it requires us to really look deep into the statute. So we're attempting to do some more cleanup. I'll call your attention to some of the highlights here. What we found out in the last year in Section 4, we actually define martial arts. Promoters had been getting around the license, the promoter's fee with us the last year, we've noticed, by just offering kickboxing events around the state, and we do not regulate kickboxing. So we do, however, say that mixed martial arts has to be a combination of two or more mixed martial arts disciplines. And some of the other highlights I have here, I'm going to keep this highlighter here. Section 6 clarifies that the commissioner has discretion over the amount of time a person needs to wait before reapplying for a license. We found that to be a hardship for some of the combatants because it took so long. In Sections 8 and 9, we clarify a promoter's license because sometimes a license is an LLC, or the promoter is a company. Some of you might recall that Mike Tyson was a licensed promoter here in the state of Minnesota most recently. He's a member of a limited liability corporation, so we had to clean that up. And let's see. Section 9 of Article 1 requires the application for a promoter's license to be completed at least 6 weeks before the scheduled combative sports event. We were finding promoters hadn't even applied for a license within a week before the event, and that's just untenable. And finally, last year we went, Mr. Chairman, you are also the chair of the Game and Fish Division. As you know, that your hunting and fishing licenses are based on different calendar. They're all based a little different. I talked to my colleague at the DNR. What we try to do is have some consistency here, and so all the licenses end December 31st. And whenever you decide you're going to engage in a contest in the next year, your license is you've got to pay for the whole 12 months. It isn't based on your anniversary date. So I'll stop there if any questions before we go to Article 2, which is a construction code statute.
Any questions? Please proceed, sir.
All right. By the way, I welcome any of you. If you'd like to attend a boxing or mixed martial arts event in your community, just let us know. They are all over the state. They aren't just in the metro area, and they are quite popular. Our state has number 7th in the country in the number of events. We found out this year as well. I also have Jessica Luna, our Assistant Commissioner for Construction Codes and Licensing here, if we have questions on Article 2. The Section 1 describes permits for some licenses to apply for it permits, some licensees to apply for a license renewal more than 2 years after the license is required. This was kind of a gap in the law that we found. So we want people to be licensed with us, not doing unregistered licensed work. This one's my favorite. It clarifies that elevators in residential buildings are not subject. This is Section 2, members. Elevators in residential buildings are not subject to annual operating permit fees, just to the fee at the time of the installation.
Sure.
And I asked one of your members about that, and she insisted that she gets it done every year because she doesn't want to get stuck on her elevator and have to call the fire service in her in the middle of the night or something. Plumbing contractors, we found in Section 4 that when a plumbing contractor who's responsible licensed individual for his company leaves that company, we decided to say that you need to get a new responsible licensed individual within 60 days. The statute was silent on that. Section 7, I apologize for my voice. If I sound a little cloudy. Clarifies that a consumer, this is a good catch for consumer protection, the residential building section of the code. It clarifies that a consumer has a right to cancel a contract with any residential contractor within 72 hours after learning that the consumer's insurance claim had been denied. They were kind of taking advantage of that. And finally, Section 8 clarifies that the commissioner can take enforcement action against a qualifying person of a residential building contractor, which that wasn't the case before. And Assistant Commissioner, if you would want to come up for Article 3, since these are all our on-session ones, and my voice is starting to get a little hacked. These are the highlights in our on-session here pertain to the construction code and licensing statute.
Well, thank you, sir.
I forgot something. Sorry for that, members. In Section 6 of Article 2, you would go back to page 11 of the bill. Upon further review by one of our attorneys, she recommended that we delete Section 6, the recommended new language there, because that would require a fee, and that wasn't our original intention. So that was an oops.
Okay. So are you
that has to, I'm asking,
that's flagged, or do we need additional amendments here?
Correct. We need that to be an oral amendment.
I see. The amendment did delete that. So just to clarify for members, that's what the A1 addressed. Thank you.
Oh, we did?
Yeah.
Never mind.
We're on top of it, sir.
You are. This is the Senate Jobs Committee. Well, I shouldn't know.
We caught that one twice today, it sounds like. So very well. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Would we like to proceed to Article 3 here?
Sure.
Yeah. If you could state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Sparks. My name is Jessica Luman. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Labor and Industry. I oversee the Construction Codes and Licensing and Labor Standards Divisions. As Mr. Ronkowski said, Article 3 and actually Article 4 are sort of our unsession efforts for the department. We are both deleting obsolete and redundant statutes, as well as we do have some repealers of programs that are not currently in effect. Article 3 specifically removes various dates that are no longer applicable, removes the references to the licensing fees and of the employment agency, which we're going to repeal in Article 4. It removes references to renewal deadline, which is causing us a great deal of confusion. We had an expiration date and a renewal deadline in our statutes, and it was causing confusion with our stakeholders. so we've removed that reference. We've removed the requirement for exit sign illumination. It is a small provision in our statute that is otherwise covered by the accessibility code and the energy code, and incorporates by reference. This is sort of the big deleting piece that you see here. One of the efforts of the many of the state agencies is to take the statewide, the national compact that we enter into so that we can do business with other states, to take the actual language out of the statute books, if you will, and incorporate them by reference. In the repealer section in Article 4, sort of the big piece that we're doing there is we're removing the licensing requirement for fee employment agencies. There are currently only two fee employment agencies licensed in the state of Minnesota. This is a sort of a throwback to the idea before temp agencies. There were agencies that workers paid to help them get jobs. And now we know that employers hire temp agencies or hire placement agencies to do that work. We're keeping all of the worker protections and the protections that were in that law. We're just removing the licensure requirement. We repeal a few redundant statutes. And then also any statutes that are specifically related to accessibility, in that those are already required in the accessibility code, which is a statewide document as opposed to this sort of piecemeal approach.
Well, very well. We can see in this article the unsession aspect of this bill. So thank you. Are there any questions among the committee at this stage for our testifiers? Any additional testimony in the audience? Well, seeing none, Senator Coonan moves that Senate File 2438, as amended, be recommended to pass. Is there any further discussion at this point?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Maybe this has already been addressed, and I apologize because I was out of the room. Are there any major policy changes in this bill?
Yes.
Or any policy changes?
Senator Sparks, I defer to you on this.
I will let the department comment, but I think this is the governor's unsession ideas, and we've shared this language and information with Senator Dames and the commissioner, so I don't think there is, but I would defer to the department to make sure that they can answer your question fully, Senator Nelson.
No, I'll just amplify, sure. Mr. Chairman and Senator Nelson. You've had the contractor registration bill in front of you today, or not today, but this week, and our apprenticeship bill by Senator Tomasoni. Those are our major policy bills for the session.
Well, very well. Well, with that, if there's no further discussion, we'll renew. Senator Coonan renews his motion that Senate File 2438, as amended, be recommended to pass. Without any further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
And opposed, no. And the motion prevails. All right, folks, that brings to a close our business today. Thank you, and the committee is adjourned.